Holden is a place of meetings. And one is always asking in one way or another, who are you? And it didn't take her brokering's extravaganza the other night to cause me to wonder about how you really answer that question if anybody is serious. And every once in a while, people are serious when they ask you who you are. At least I'm assuming that we're serious part of the time. And I want you to go over in your own mind right now with me the answer to the question. Who are you? What do you say when somebody asks you, who are you? First, what do you say? Usually your name. Now, my name is Alvin, and there's not much in that name. I mean, it has not much of a history. I have an uncle by that name, but that's about as far as you can go. But now, if you had a name like Rachel, or Mary, or Elizabeth, or Martha, or Sarah, or Ruth, or David, or John, or Peter, or Paul, or Mark, you know, there'd be much more in that name than is in Alvin. Much more in that name. And to me, it means a great deal more when somebody has a name that has a history. Because the name, to name anything, is really to involve it in a history. And those names have long histories. Well, what's the second thing we usually talk about when we ask that question or answer that question? I guess it's somehow your location, geographically. Now, if I said I was an Englishman from Chicago, it wouldn't mean very much. If I said I was a Norwegian from Minnesota, then it would have some meaning. Or even a Swede from Minnesota would have. But an Englishman from Chicago. Well, the third thing. What do we begin to think about the third thing? What do you think about third? Well, as I was thinking about, we begin to think about relations. I'm the daughter of, or I'm the wife of, or I'm the son of, and sometimes you might even say I'm the husband of, but not too often. Although more and more we'd say, now I guess that we're the husband of somebody. Or Tim says he's the roommate of Peter. And since I know Peter, that really means something. Or Dan and Nancy are friends of Dick and Joanne. And that begins to mean something. Well, we talk about friends or relations or relatives. And then where do we go? Well, then we usually go to the church. Now, again, it might mean something. It might be at least interesting if I were to say I'm an ordained Baptist minister attending the Hyde Park Lutheran Church, which is Missouri Synod Lutheran. Now, that would be an interesting fact, at least. But again, that doesn't mean very much to you. And if I knew the big Lutheran churches, you name one of those big churches, and immediately you are associated with something. It establishes something. And I suppose the fifth thing is probably the job, or if you're in school. Paulette said yesterday she had graduated from high school and she was entering the Navy. Well, that was a kind of interesting thing. But it's kind of the job or the school or where you're working, or maybe it's what you do at Holden. that comes next. And maybe after a while you begin to talk about what you have done. So, what do we know about each other when we've said all that? I used to ask this question, and I said, what is really interesting about you? Now, I got a few strange answers occasionally. I wanted to know what was really interesting that somebody wanted to tell me. What was really interesting? I was trying to break through some of this usual stuff, but I guess really we do want to go through this usual stuff. Well, last year, just about this time, and I don't know why it was just about this time, I had the same Bible verse to talk about. It was Mary and Martha. It's that passage in Luke. It's a very familiar story to you, and I'll just read it to you. Don't worry, I'm not going to preach the same sermon. It's over on tape, and if you want to hear it, you can go and hear it. But this is an interesting story, and it's the Bible verse for this week, and so I'm trying to work it in some way. Now, as they went on their way, he entered a village, and a woman named Martha received him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she went to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me. But the Lord answered her, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. One thing is needful. Mary has chosen the good portion, which shall not be taken away from her. Now, I don't know what the good portion is, always. Tom is a very successful professional. He's worked all his life. He earned his way through school. He's been on church boards. He's a very respected citizen. And he's thinking about selling out his business and hiring out to his partner now, selling out to his partner so he won't have to work so much, work 35 or 40 hours a week, and he'll have some time to do some things that he wants to do. But he says if he does that, he probably won't have the money to bring all his kids to Holden, five kids, and no, he won't have the money. So he's in somewhat of a dilemma. Ron McConnell told me of a friend of his, which, you get the point, I guess. When is he being Mary and when is he being Martha? Ron McConnell told me of a friend of his with 3 degrees, including a PhD, and they've decided not to have any children. They bought a little farm in Canada. And they're settling down, and they figure they can make it there if they don't have to worry about putting kids through college and all that kind of thing. And which role is the Mary role? Which role is the Martha role? 2 very successful executives. All these people have been here, or are here, or are friends of people who have been here. 2 very successful executives are wondering why they should expend their substance, give their lives to produce more stuff that they think is adding to our problem as a nation. They really believe that economic growth is an idol. And they think we ought to quit growing economically. We ought to quit buying all the things we do. And they are helping produce them. And sometimes they're producing things that go for things they don't believe in, even beyond simply the production of things. That is, they're producing things for some very dubious ventures. But they've spent their lives in this profession, and their whole identity is wrapped up, to use Erickson's familiar term, the fifth stage in the developmental cycle. Their whole identity is wrapped up with their roles. And they don't really know who they are. Who are you? Who are you really? There's another passage for this week, and it's the focus, really, for what I want to say, or reflect upon, or think with you about. Have you go read it and think about it. The passage for this week begins in Colossians, the first chapter and the 21st verse, but I got to go back and get a little head start. I mean, I got to get up some steam. So in the 15th verse, he's talking about his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption and the forgiveness of sins, and he says, He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you, who were once estranged and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and irreproachable before him, provided that you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which has been preached to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister. And then as we move over into the second chapter, I wanted to pick up a few verses where Paul is talking about how Christ has disarmed the principalities and powers and made a public example of them, triumphing over them in him, in him. Now, who are you? Who am I? I am a person for whom Christ died. That's a kind of audacious statement to make. And provided I continue in the faith, that is, provided I really am grasped by God's act in Jesus Christ, and my confidence in myself is shattered, he will be for me. That is to say, he will be for me. He will make it possible for me to quit having to prove myself to know more than my parents, even though I often do, or as parents to know more than my children, although I often do, to be concerned about what I've done or wrote or what I'm going to do or produce or how things are going. He will reconcile me to God. He will reconcile me to myself. He will reconcile me to my fellow man. He will help me in that reconciliation, accept life as a gift. Whatever you've been, whatever you've done, whatever you've thought, it really does not count. If you can declare and believe and feel and know and sense that you are a person for whom Christ died, you no longer have to appear to be what you're not. You no longer have to be person pleasers. The Bible has it, men pleasers. You no longer have to be a parent pleaser or a child pleaser if you want to take transactional analysis, and I know it's a dubious thing to take, but you are a person for whom Christ died, for whom Christ was crucified. A person toward whom God moves without regard to what you are or have been. That's a tremendous affirmation. And if you make it with your being, it transforms your existence. And Richard Nixon is a person for whom Christ died. It may take a long time. May have to plant those seeds, as we saw on the stage Wednesday night, several times. But Richard Nixon is a person for whom Christ died. Who am I? I'm a person in whom Christ lived. Now that's even more audacious, I think. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Cindy Moe asked me just yesterday why I spent so much time in the freedom movement with Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson. And I told her I didn't know. I don't know. Now there are all kinds of explanations. I may have been really trying to run away from something. But there is a simple explanation, I think. That's at least a possible explanation. And I think I took seriously, without really thinking very much about it, the hymns and the rituals and the Bible verses I learned in Sunday school and youth groups. And the theology I read in seminary. I grew up in a Methodist church, and there was no East and West, no South and North. At least we sang about it. And one great fellowship of love throughout the whole wide earth. And I have a feeling I believed it. You know, I just think it got down into my very guts. Now, Paul said it in kind of high-sounding words, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. But somehow my being, my whole being was conditioned or created or transformed to feel, at least part of the time, that mankind is like a body with feet and hands and eyes and ears. We are parts of each other. And every now and then I believe it. I feel it. It's not only believing it with your mind, I feel it. Now, sometimes it's not easy to decide whether everyone is part of our body or whether it's just the people who believe the same way we do or make the sign of the cross the way we do. And I guess I don't know about that, because I tend to think that it's very difficult to know those persons for whom Christ died and locate them by any simple signs. Who are you? Who are you? Are you a person for whom Christ died? Are you a person in whom Christ dwells? Now, third, and I'm much less sure of this, but somehow it seems to be a part of what I have to affirm. I'm a person through whom the principalities and powers are defeated, or opposed and undermined. And I use the principalities and powers in a fairly negative sense here. I think one could use principality and power in a much more positive sense, but I'm using them in a way which I think identifies the principalities and powers with racism and sexism and nationalism, and I got a lot of words here, some I've invented, scientism and possessionism. That one I did really invent. And I don't know what to do with this one, technologyism. And I added the last one, political opportunism. That doesn't really say what happens when a government gets captured by a spirit such as a government like Stalin's or a government like Hitler's, where a government really gets captured by a spirit which is absolutely destructive because it's just out for power for the sake of power. Know how to put that in words, but I think you know what I mean. And I think that I'm a person through whom God in Christ is working to defeat these powers. And I know there are all kinds of theological problems as to whether Christ has defeated them by his death on the cross and his resurrection, and what it means if he's defeated them, then what? Why do we have all these things now and so forth? So the way I've put it, it may be theologically very suspect, but the way it's meaningful for me is that I am a person through whom these powers, or let me put it in a more community-oriented way, I think the church is a reality through whom these powers are being defeated. I don't have any simple doctrine of the church either, but I know about most of the doctrines. Who are you? How do you answer that question? Who am I? And I dare to say, with all the audaciousness involved, and with fear and trembling, that I am a person for whom Christ died. I am a person in whom Christ lives. And I am a person through whom the principalities and powers are being defeated. I am a member of a body through whom the principalities and powers are being defeated. Let us pray.